From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics review a remake of Suspiria, Dakota Johnson and Tilda Swinton star, Hunter Killer, an action thriller starring Gerard Butler, Gary Oldman, and Common. And we'll hear about the action comedy Johnny English Strikes Again, starring Rowan Atkinson. It all comes your way in this edition of Film Week. Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Such pleasure to have you with us. This week, our critics are Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of the What the Flick podcast, available at ChristyLemire.com. That's L-E-M-I-R-E. Wade Major of Cinegods.com, and they're both gods right here at KPCC's Film Week, Film Gods. Let's start with Suspiria, the horror mystery starring Dakota Johnson, Tilda Swinton, and I love the name Mia Goth. Luca Guadagnino is the director, and David Kaganich is the screenwriter. Christy, what'd you think of the remake of Suspiria?
So the first time I saw Suspiria, I was like, what did I just see? And then the second time I saw it, I gave myself over to the rhythms of it and the visuals, and it gets under your skin. It's a remake, but it's really more of an expansion on the original Suspiria, which is very famous Dario Argento horror classic from 1977. The premise here is the same. It takes place at a German dance academy, which is actually a front for a coven of witches. And they are looking for their newest dancer who can be their vessel into which they can pour all of their evil and carry on their tradition. And Dakota Johnson is that in this telling of it. But it also aims beyond trying to scare us, shock us, whatever. It aims to exist in the larger world within a historical context. And that is where it doesn't quite work for me. It takes place in 1977 in Berlin, in a city that is still trying to reestablish itself after World War II, after Nazism. It's still a city split in two. And you have all this Bader-Meinhof violence going on in the streets. And Luca Guadagnino tries to incorporate what's happening at the dance academy with the tumult in the outside world. That does not work. What works is the mood, the deeply creepy mood. And he really takes his time and he wants to get under your skin and he wants to disturb you, as all his films are, like I Am Love and A Bigger Splash and Call Me By Your Name. It is masterfully crafted. It is beautifully shot, edited just exquisitely. There's one scene of just cross-cutting between Dakota Johnson dancing in one rehearsal hall and the vicious way that another dancer is being torn apart by her moves like a voodoo doll that is just chilling and thrilling at the same time. It does take its time. It is, whereas the original Suspiria was like lush and lurid and splashed in primary colors, this is very stern and very severe. And for a long time, Dakota Johnson's braid is the only source of color. And then it explodes in a bloody orgy.
Wade?
That's a great description of the movie. It still isn't selling it to me. Look, here's the thing. The original Suspiria, depending on the cut, there are a few different cuts, but they're all kind of around 90 minutes. The original Suspiria, 90 minutes. This one, 152 minutes. There's an additional hour of material that Luca has imbued into this storyline. And that's not substantially changing it. It's just that he's letting it breathe more. He's opening it up more. He's giving the actors more time to do the same things. He's giving the story a little bit more time to sort of evolve, which I guess is a positive thing. I don't like Dario Argento or his movies. I mean, I don't, you know, dislike the man personally.
Nothing personal, yeah.
Nothing personal. I just don't like his style of filmmaking. I don't like the giallo genre generally. They're all kind of the unholy spawn of Rosemary's Baby and Roman Polanski. He kind of changed. Giallo predates Polanski, but he introduced something into the DNA of international cinema that it took and ran with. And people of Argento's generation did a lot of that, and they did here too. There are like a dozen movies from the same era with, you know, Shelley Winters playing a satanic sorority mom.
But hard to do it anywhere near the quality of Rosemary's Baby.
Oh, absolutely. Rosemary's Baby is the pinnacle. And when you start trying to do that over and over and over, everything starts to feel derivative and a little bit worn out. The original Suspiria did nothing for me at the time, so it is sort of natural that this is going to do nothing for me right now. at the same time, I respect what Luca Guadagnino is trying to do. He's trying to take, because he is an Italian filmmaker with one foot very much in the 70s and one foot very much in the now. And he's sort of trying to find the artistic umbilical cord that connects those two periods, especially in Italian cinema. So he sees this as something more artful than I think what most film critics perhaps have given Suspiria credit for over the years. And he's trying to say, no, this is a more interesting and a more artful story, and here's what you can do with it when you put it in the hands of a director who really, really understands it. That said, if you don't like Suspiria to begin with, none of that is going to work for you. But if you do, it certainly will.
But this is so different from the original Suspiria.
Yeah, tonally, not enough. Not different enough.
Substantially, in terms of what the larger themes are, totally it is. I want to mention really fast, I love the Tom York score. Tom York from Radiohead did the theme, did the score, as a layer of melancholy and mystery from the very, very beginning. Tilda Swinton, who is Luca's muse and great friend, is just magnificent here as the choreographer who runs the place. I was severely creeped out. I dug it.
It's still about witches in a dancing school.
Is that a bad thing?
Yeah, it is.
Why don't you enjoy that? Why don't you embrace
that? Because during the 1970s, I must have seen 180 movies about witches.
It's awesome.
And they're all the same.
I want to join their coven. They're fun.
Oh, say it ain't so. Suspiria from director Luca Guadagnino. David Kaganich is the screenwriter. The movie is rated R. It's at the Arclight in Hollywood. Hunter Killer, an action thriller set on a submarine, directed by Donovan Marsh. It was written by Jamie Moss and Arne Schmidt, based on the book Firing Point, the film starring Gerard Butler, Gary Oldman, and Common, about an untested American submarine captain who teams with U.S. Navy SEALs to rescue the Russian president who's been kidnapped by a rogue general.
I told Sixth Fleet you want a hunter killer.
We don't have one in the Yukon region, not with the rescue sub-attachment.
We do. We have one.
No, son. Arkansas just lost a skipper.
And I assigned her a new one. He's in the region, never been a captain.
Joe Glass. Where the hell did you find him? What class was he?
Never went to Annapolis, sir.
He never went to Annapolis? Wade.
Oh, whatever. So you've got a rogue Russian general who wants to start World War III. So that's taken from Dr. Strangelove. And then he kidnaps the Russian president. So that's Air Force One. And then an American special forces team has to go into Russia to try to set things right. So that's behind enemy lines. And then you've got Gerard Butler on the nuclear sub trying to come to the rescue on the other side. So that's Crimson Tide meets Hunt for Red October.
Doing the animated films where
it's just you sit there and you just start counting down all the dumb action movies. And, you know, certainly Strangelove is not dumb, but everything that's borrowed from another movie. And it's all mashed up, and obviously the novel being the source material, the novel is a mashup to begin with. But it's so preposterous, and it's so ridiculous, and it's so over the top, and it's just so terrible. And everyone tries to be so convincing, which makes it even worse. And then the credits run, and you see all the names, the producers in the credits, you know, Doug Urbanski and Neil Moritz and the Hadidas, and it's like they just go and find everybody who has some kind of, like, giant testosterone injection on their resume and just pile them all into one movie. It's too much action cliche for one movie. It's too much action cliche for a dozen movies. It's just too much.
Hunter Killer, starring Gerard Butler, Gary Oldman, and Common. It's rated R in wide release. The spy comedy Johnny English Strikes Again, written by William Davies. David Kerr is the director who makes his feature directorial debut. Rowan Atkinson, back as bumbling spy Johnny English, forced to come out of retirement after a cyber attack reveals the identities of all the active undercover agents in Britain.
Destination?
South of France, sir.
Arm the missiles.
They're just cyclists, sir.
They're French cyclists, Bob. And they're obstructing Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Rowan Atkinson is Johnny English, Wade.
I'm sorry that I actually find that funny. So this is the third Johnny English movie, the first 2003, then 2011, and now they take their time putting them out. Pretty much every Rowan Atkinson movie is an excuse for him to do Mr. Bean shtick, We have to remember that. So even though he is a spy, he is a super spy, the whole point is to get him into situations where he can stick his tongue out and bend his face and do his funny little dance and kind of just do the shtick that we're accustomed to him doing with his incredibly rubbery visage. And I have to say the Johnny English movies keep getting better. They're still not very good. But they keep getting better. The original one I didn't think was very funny. The second one, Johnny English Reborn, was so-so. This one, despite being really dumb, has an interesting thing on its mind, and it is this. That Johnny English is now retired, and he has to come out because all of the actual active spies have been revealed in a cyber attack. So they need to go to the spies who are not active, and he's not on the grid. And of course, now that this cyber attack has revealed all of their digital insecurity, he wants nothing to do with cell phones or electric cars that have GPS. Everything is analog because we're going totally off the grid, old school. And that's a really interesting idea, especially considering that the villain here is basically Google. They kind of throw a red herring at you that isn't very convincing, that maybe it's the Russians, but really, it's Google. It's a Silicon Valley billionaire who wants to take over the world by essentially strong-arming the G12 into giving him all of their data.
You just revealed the plot.
Yeah, it's, the, it's not hard to figure out. It's and so it's a big swipe at a very timely topic, which is data mining and the fact that our data and privacy is out there for the whole world, and how is it being used. And Google has taken a lot of hits, and they're going to take more because of this movie. So I thought it was a very interesting way of taking the Johnny English character and that world and all the shtick that goes with it and wrapping it around an idea that is a little more interesting than what the two previous films had.
All right, Johnny English Strikes Again, third in the series starring Rowan Atkinson. It's rated PG in wide release. The documentary On Her Shoulders profiles Nadia Murad, a 23-year-old Yazidi survivor of genocide and sexual slavery. The film is directed by Alexandria Bombach in her feature directorial debut. Christy, you want to start us?
So this is about Nadia Murad, who, as a young Yazidi woman, was taken hostage by ISIS and turned into their sex slave. She is one of many, many women, young women, children to whom this horrific fate has befallen. She managed to escape and in the subsequent years has toured the world, talking to world leaders, visiting refugee camps, and telling her story, but also really trying to urgently call nations to action to help protect the Yazidi people and to go after ISIS and to do everything they can to keep this horrific future from becoming reality for so many people. And it's about how she balances all of that pressure. I mean, in terms of internally, how she has dealt with her own grief and her own loss of innocence, but also the pressure that's been put on her to be a hero and an inspiration. And, you know, she's a kind of a quiet young woman, and she has to get up in front of the UN General Assembly and make her case. And it's really heartbreaking and really inspiring. It reminded me quite a bit of the Malala Yousafzai documentary that came out a few years back, in terms of you have this woman who never wanted this, who never asked for this, but now is in a position where she has to stand up for people who don't have that kind of visibility, who don't have that kind of voice. And it's really inspiring. She gets a lot of help from Amal Clooney as far as pleading her case before the UN General Assembly. She has a husband. Is he her husband, Wade?
No.
He's not her husband yet, but he stood by her. Yeah. And clearly he's a little bit older. He wants to have a family, but he's being patient and not pressuring her and like letting her do what she has to do for the greater good. And she's just so lovely. Quite often she will just speak into the camera and say, I wish people would talk to me about more substantive topics. And they ask me about the gratuitous details of being raped by these people. And it's just, it's, she's so subtle in everything she says that it's heartbreaking.
Wade?
I'm normally really, really good at distancing myself from the subject of a film and being able to, you know, regardless of whatever the politics or whatever the subject matter may be, being able to evaluate it as a movie. And I think it says a lot about this movie and probably a lot about me that I couldn't do that here. And
yeah, difficult, you know, movie to watch.
Well,
clearly
my mother was a war refugee, you know, and I knew I was gonna lose it on the air.
I'm sorry.
And I grew up hearing these stories from a different point of view, from a World War II point of view. But and, you know, 15 months ago, I spent time at a Syrian refugee camp in Jordan and heard the stories again. And so you watch this film, if you have any connection to that, and even if you don't, you can't help but have it just completely get under your skin. It is what's extraordinary about this, and full disclosure, the editorial consultant on the film was Doug Blush, who's a kind of a superstar editor and a friend of mine. And I emailed him afterwards and I said, I'm sitting here, I'm just weeping. And he said, it's all about Alexandria, the director. He said, we just pared away everything so that Nadia's voice was what really carried the film. There was no editorializing by the filmmakers. And that's what it is. It's her voice, and it's such an important voice.
The voice of Nadia Murad, who is one of two recipients of this year's Nobel Peace Prize. Her story told on Her Shoulders, Unrated, Lemley's Monica Film Center. Back with more in a minute. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Wade Major and Christy Lemire. Next is the documentary Shirkers, directed by Sandy Tan, making her feature writing and directing debut. Christy, what'd you think of Shirkers?
Totally fascinating and endlessly challenging and engrossing, and it keeps changing, and I love that about it. So Sandy Tan, when she was a teenager growing up in Singapore, loved movies and loved pop culture and figured out ways to get her hands on things that weren't readily available in Singapore at the time in the early 90s. And she made her own movie. She and her best friends just got equipment and figured out how to make their own movie. And in time, the footage of that was lost. And this film explores what happened to it, what happened to her, who she was as a young person growing up in Singapore. She has to sort of go back and revisit those friends and go back and revisit those creative impulses and explore what was the deal with this much older man who was sort of a film teacher to her and her friends, but also like kind of a really inappropriate, much older friend, quote unquote, who kind of took them all for a ride and took off with the footage and took off with their money. And when you see the footage of her film, which is also called Shirkers, it's got this really cool, surreal vibe to it. And in a way that predates like early Wes Anderson films or the movie Ghost World. I'm wearing my Ghost World t-shirt today in honor of it.
Yeah.
It's not a coincidence. And she juxtaposes her own Shirkers footage with images from those cool movies that came out much later. And it's an interesting exploration of like history and memory and who we really are compared to who we think we really are, and I loved it.
So was she a teenager at the time?
She was 19.
Mm-hmm. And what has she done? Would it ruin it to tell what she's been doing in the years since?
Well, no, not really. One of the things she's done in the years since is marry our colleague, John Powers.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So a full disclosure again, anyone who knows John Powers is already going to be inclined to love this movie, even though it is great. But yes, John Powers, formerly the LA Weekly,
formerly Film Week,
and currently critic at Vogue. So, it just makes me so happy that we're, 1-2 degrees removed from such an incredible talent. The thing that's most fascinating to me about this film is that it has this really wonderful, fateful meta quality to it, which is here's a movie about the movie with the same name. And this guy who ruined her first movie now becomes the villain of this movie in such a way that he has actually now facilitated a better career for her than she might have had she made the original movie. You know, you get into this really interesting loop of what if things had gone right the first time? If they'd gone right the first time, would she be here today? But because they went wrong, now she has an even bigger career. And what's even interesting about that is that the first Shirkers that she wrote at the time and starred in was something she did voluntarily. She created that. The story that now transpires, that brings it here, is something that transpired out of her control. But it was the genius of her story sense to realize she now was involuntarily in a story that was bigger than the story she originally wanted to tell. And that's the story she made into a movie. So her instincts as a storyteller and as a filmmaker are impeccable. And I cannot wait to see what she does next. I think it's wonderful. It's an explosion of a career at a moment that I think is just absolutely wonderful.
Singapore native, but now Southern Californian, Sandy Tan. Her new film, Shirkers, a documentary about her life in Singapore and filmmaking back in the early 90s. It's on Netflix, streaming now, and can be seen on the big screen at Lemley's Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills. Shirkers is unrated. Viper Club, a drama directed by Miriam Keshavarz, who co-wrote the screenplay with Jonathan Mastro, stars Susan Sarandon, Matt Bomer, and Edie Falco. Sarandon plays a nurse whose journalist son is kidnapped in Syria and has to find her own way to save his life when the government won't help.
Do you think I'm afraid of a jail sentence?
Everyone who assists you, you'll send them to jail too.
I know the government won't help you, but there is someone else.
I'm here because I want to bring Andy home. We have our own network. There's only one thing these assholes respond to, and it's money.
Viper Club. Christy.
So Susan Sarandon is very good in this, and she has really great chemistry, and you know, understandably so, with Edie Falco, who is always great in everything. Susan Sarandon plays this ER nurse who is really in control of everything all the time, and calmly and assuredly so. But when her son goes missing, she tries to apply those same traits, those same skills to tracking him down, and it's much more difficult than she imagines it will be. Friends of his try to help. The FBI says it's trying to help. She tried to put together some money behind the scenes secretly with the help of Edie Falco, who is this very wealthy woman whose son previously also had gone missing. It's an interesting kind of character study that just sort of ends. You know, it's sort of dour, 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 and then it ends in a very frustrating, disappointing way.
Yeah, to me, it's not really about the plot per se. It's something that would have been a kind of a routine, maybe edgier than usual Lifetime movie, if not for Susan Sarandon. And this is this speaks to how amazing she still is as an actress and what she can bring to a film that may be several notches below what she would normally do and how she can elevate it. And it really is all about her performance. If you think too much about the plot, you'll realize it's kind of routine and not necessarily going anywhere. And it doesn't really sort of, in a way, it doesn't matter where it goes. What matters is that she is convincing in her emotions and that you feel for her as a mother.
Susan Sarandon starring in Viper Club, rated R at the Landmark West L.A. Life and Nothing More, written and directed by Antonio Mendez Esparza, Andrew Bleachington, Regina Williams, and Robert Williams star. In the film, Wade?
Yeah, Esparza is a Spanish filmmaker, so it's incredibly, it says a lot about him that he's able to make a movie that is so completely inside a particular American experience. This is almost like a companion film to the Florida Project, I think, in some respects, for me at least. It's about a black family in Florida and simply the day-to-day struggles that they go through given circumstances, particularly that it's a mother and a son. His father's in prison. Mother takes up with a new guy who's trying to be a father figure, but, you know, they don't really see – he and the father guy, the new father figure, don't see eye to eye. And it's done in a very semi-improvised, near-realistic way so that you have that uncomfortable feeling of being a fly on the wall. It's incredibly powerful, incredibly effective. These are all non-actors, non-professional actors, and they do an amazing job. It's a very effective film.
Yeah, so Life and Nothing More played the festival circuit last year. And so earlier this year, it was a Spirit Award nominee, and it won the John Cassavetes Prize for films that are made for $500,000 or less. And so they really accomplished quite a bit here, very convincingly, on a small budget. And Regina Williams, who had never acted before, is just a powerhouse. And one of the fascinating things here is watching her evolve and watching her blossom and watching her figure out who she needs to be in each situation, whether it's dealing with her wayward teenage son or dealing with customers at the diner where she works or letting herself maybe fall in love with one of the customers who is sweetly persistent in flirting with her. She lets herself be vulnerable in ways that she really hadn't been for a long time, quite obviously. And yeah, it really works in the subtle observations of a life. And it sounds like it would be so easy to just put non-actors on a camera and let them be versions of themselves. And it is not. When you see true acting, it is just Wonderful.
But there's something also to say about the photography, because when this happens, when people who do not have experience being blocked and kind of doing takes are put into a situation where they have to be comfortable, you have to put the camera someplace that enables them to do what they're doing in a different way than a professional actor would. And that's where I think, as far as his genius is that he always finds these beautifully composed shots that allow you to feel like you're watching like this is a real movie, but the actors are not being intruded upon by the production. It's an incredibly well-planned and well-executed movie.
Antonio Mendez Esparza's film Life and Nothing More can be seen at Lemley's Playhouse Pasadena, Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica. It's unrated. The comedic drama A Bread Factory, Parts 1 and 2, stars Tyne Daly and Elizabeth Henry Macari. The film was written and directed by Patrick Wang. Wade?
So it's important to point out this is a film that is in two parts. It is 4 hours long. That's why it's in four parts. Two parts. Each part is roughly 2 hours in length. So 2 hours, and then go see part two. I haven't heard anyone else make the observation, and I'm kind of surprised. This is almost like a Robert Altman film. It has a Robert Altman quality to it in the sense that the way that Wang shoots it and the time and the leisure that he gives to the way the story unfolds basically takes place in an upstate New York small community where there's an old bread factory that is now an arts center where they do, you know, theater and other performance. And it's now going to be corporatized and converted into this thing where this very bizarre kind of postmodern performance art is going to be the new standard of the day. And there's this team that they're very weird and quirky and nobody really likes this. And Tyne Daly represents the townsfolk, the people who want to preserve what they've had. And boy, it takes a long time to get going, but it's interesting.
It sneaks up on you because it's really intimate, but also hugely ambitious. And yeah, the length is part of it, but it's also a massive cast. And each person really gets a lovely moment or two of very true, very rich character development, much more so than you might expect. And yeah, there are some long monologues where an actor will just like tell a very long story.
When people are performing, they're performing.
But then people do, in the second half is very playful and people like burst into song and like people will burst into a tap dancing routine while they're typing on their phone in the middle of a coffee shop. And then they do big chunks of Hecuba and these like lovely, modest, small town people give these powerhouse performances. And the point being, we all have art in us and art is all around us all the time, which sounds like they're beating you over the head with a really facile notion, but it's kind of lovely the way it all ends up.
I feel like Robert Altman is smiling at this movie. It has that Nashville quality to it. It really does.
A Bread Factory in two parts, more than 4 hours total running time. A Bread Factory is unrated. It's written and directed by Patrick Wang and is at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica. The Price of Everything, a documentary about the contemporary art world. Nathaniel Kahn, the director. Wade?
Yeah, not earth-shattering, but a really interesting doc about the relationship of money and the art world. And they talk to artists and they talk to dealers and collectors. And it's very, very illuminating because everyone kind of agrees money can corrupt the art world, but they need it at the same time. And it's a conundrum that isn't really resolved, and nor can it be resolved. But I love the fact that it sort of immersed me in that world and introduced me to all these really interesting people. And there's one woman in particular who's an art dealer who says the most interesting thing about art. She says, some people see, some need to be shown, and some will never see. Thought that was a perfect way of summing it up.
It's sort of a fascinating conversation, too, about where does art belong? Should someone pay $50 million for a de Kooning or whatever it is, or should they donate what they have to a museum? There's one gentleman in Chicago who donated his $400 million collection of contemporary art to the Art Institute of Chicago. Is that where it belongs? Or should it be in your house because you truly treasure it? Should it be for the masses or should it be for the few? I was staggered at the prices, at the price of everything.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. And sort of fitting with a bread factory, it's about the collision between art and commerce.
Well, and the other thing is that, of course, for every high-level art museum, a tiny part of its collection is ever visible to the public.
They mentioned that, too. A lot of it's in storage.
It's in storage, exactly. The Price of Everything. Thing, documentary on the contemporary art world, will be shown on HBO in a couple of weeks, but you can see it right now. Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills, The Price of Everything, directed by Nathaniel Kahn, is unrated. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Much more to come after this. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Wade Major and Christy Lemire. We have another film to review. It's Border, Sweden's entry for Oscar consideration. It's directed by Ali Abbasi, who co-wrote the screenplay. Christy, what did you think of this Swedish romantic mystery?
Oh, my goodness. That makes it sound like an understandable thing when you call it a Swedish romantic mystery. There is so much going on here.
And yet not that much.
And yet, once we get down to it, once it starts explaining itself, it's not that interesting. But it is about a woman who is a security guard, a customs agent at the border in Sweden. And she has this incredible sense of smell that allows her to pick up when someone is lying or they're nervous
she
smells fear. She smells guilt. And so she can tell when someone's lying about stuff they're smuggling into the country. And sometimes that's really helpful. Like she can find a guy has, you know, child porn hidden in his phone or whatever. But she's a misfit and she's misunderstood and she's got some facial deformities. And then one day she meets a man who's just like her. And that's kind of interesting, too, until it isn't, until you find out who they really are. I don't want to give away who they really are.
You can't really. You almost can't even talk about this without giving the whole thing away. It takes about an hour to start showing its cards. And once it does, it's not that interesting anymore. It's interesting when it's a mystery and when it's an unanswered question. And then you realize, oh, this is basically just a traditional spy film, a trope that you've seen in a hundred other movies, but they just kind of flipped it a little bit, and it's not that rich at that point. What is interesting, though, is her performance. That's the thing I'll give it credit for. You know, the actress, the Swedish actress,
Eva Melander,
has this, you know, Neanderthal like prosthetic with the brow, and she snorts like she's a bloodhound, and you're immediately wondering what is up with this woman, and she's able to act through all of that latex and all of the prosthetics to really kind of imbue this very unusual character with a level of humanity that I would not have expected given all the entrappings. So
yeah, there's great vulnerability to her. You really feel for her, and she gets taken advantage of a lot.
Yeah.
So
Border, it's the Swedish film from director Ali Abbasi. It's rated R at the ArcLight in Hollywood. I want to mention a couple of important things in film. One of them is a very positive news that Hayao Miyazaki is going to be given the Los Angeles Film Critics Association Career Achievement Award. That is set for early next year. And this is a major honor. Our own Charles Solomon will be one of the co-presenters of that honor. Wade, quick thought on Miyazaki being honored.
I think it's amazing. We've only honored one animator before, Chuck Jones, and this is only the second time. It's the first animator. Anime is such an enormously influential.
You set the bar high, Chuck Jones and Miyazaki.
And Miyazaki is an enormous figure. Anime is still hugely influential, has been for over a half a century, and Miyazaki, arguably its greatest practitioner.
So that's good news. Christy, there's bad news to report to. Warner Media is shutting down Filmstruck. This is the classic film streaming service. For those who don't have cable or satellite, don't get Turner Classic Movies. This was the way to get these classic films that Amazon Prime and Netflix aren't really interested in.
It's really unfortunate because it was just a huge, rich resource for people who really love film. And it's everything from hard-to-find art house stuff to Citizen Kane and everything in between. And it was available at your fingertips. I guess they felt it wasn't profitable enough or too niche-y or whatever.
It was
too
niche.
But it's really unfortunate. It's a huge loss.
It's more than unfortunate. It's infuriating. And it's indicative of a strategy that has been pursued by previously by Comcast and News Corp and all of the corporate owners of the major studios and now AT&T with Warner, where they simply don't see the value in the library. It's not moving the needle on stock price every quarterly report. So why even bother appealing to people who love classic movies? And that's a tragedy because this is our heritage. If we didn't have those movies, we wouldn't have anything new.
Let's hope that some company comes in and is able to license the streaming of these films in lieu of Warner's and get them out there. I think one of the challenges might be, and I have no inside information on this, that for the older viewers who are typically going to be most interested in these films, they still have satellite and cable subscriptions, largely get Turner Classics. And what I'm wondering is if, you know, as younger people get more and more interested in these films and are not subscribing to the more expensive packages, maybe at that point the streaming service will catch on with these films.
From your lips.
I hope that that's the case.
And again, there are no more brick and mortar stores to go rent these movies in. Mm-hmm. So it's got to be held somewhere.
Warner Media shutting down Filmstruck. This just, 4 months after AT&T bought Time Warner. Definitely bad news for those of us that are film lovers.
KPCC podcast supporters include UCLA Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Josh Fox with his new work, The Truth Has Changed. From the director of Gasland comes a live performance tracing the arc of American politics from 9/11 to Trump. From his experiences as an eyewitness to 9/11, the BP oil spill, Bernie Sanders campaign, and Standing Rock, Fox delivers an insightful account of how we got to where we are today. October 27th at Brood Playhouse. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC, and we turn our attention now to a growing concern in movies about actors being able to permanently digitize their images. With 360-degree scanning of their face and body, actors can live on long after their earthly bodies have deceased. So the question is, though, who owns that image, and in what ways could it be used in the future? And should actors be concerned about how those images might be put to work? Joining us is Darren Hendler, who's director of the Digital Humans Group at Digital Domain. It's an Oscar-winning visual effects studio based in Playa Vista. They've worked on Avengers Infinity War and Ready Player One, and they have digitally scanned a number of actors. Darren Hendler, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Larry, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. So, I mean, I think it's one thing to scan actors and to use them in current films, but, you know, what happens to those scans of the actors, you know, going down the road? Who owns that scan of the actor?
So in all cases, and we're very, very careful about this, you know, we work very, very closely with the studios. And so when an actor comes in, they're getting scanned and they're getting scanned, and the material's only really ever being used for that one movie that they're being scanned for. We've worked with different actors, different studios. You know, the rights, it's sometimes the studios have the rights, sometimes the actors have the rights. But always, whenever we're working on this, and this data is very, very sensitive, and we treat it that way, you know, we're really never using it for anything other than that specific role that it was brought in for or what we were planning on scanning the actor for the first time.
I wonder, too, about the limits of the technology, because even if you can scan super accurately the physical body of the actor, there's so many other things that go into acting in the moment that a human being does. Anticipation, playing with rhythms. There's much that can be difficult, I would think, to recreate using a scanned image.
Absolutely. And that's actually one of the key things, and one of the key things we talk to and work with a lot of the actors on. You know, we work a lot of technology to really capture what the actor's doing, how they're capturing their performance, so we can transfer it onto their digital likeness, onto their digital creature. But we don't really have any ways to sort of manufacture a performance that is the actor doing the performance, right? We may have their likeness or what their face looks like, but we can't suddenly make it speak or act in any way like the way they're doing. And most of the technology that's being worked on at the moment is this idea, how do we better capture the actor's performance, what they're doing, the subtlety in what they're doing, and transfer it onto their older or younger self or onto a different creature? And there we're actually really trying to get more of the actor's performance, not less of it, and we're not trying to make it up ourselves or manufacture it.
We're talking with Darren Handler, director of the Digital Humans Group at Digital Domain. Also with us is Jennifer Rothman, professor at Loyola Law School. She teaches right to publicity and intellectual property law. And in fact, earlier this year, her book, The Right of Publicity, was just published. Professor Rothman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So is the law very clear about who owns these scans?
Yes and no. It depends on the individual instance. There's not a specific law that talks about digitized humans and who owns them. Instead, what the law does is there are a number of laws that overlap in this area. So there's a state law, which my book was about, called the Right of Publicity. It's also sometimes protected in state laws about the right of privacy. And those say that you can't use someone's name or likeness or voice without their permission, strictly for the defendant's advantage. So that would apply to these digitized images.
And we'll pick up with the other law that would apply as we continue. From Loyola Law School, Jennifer Rothman joining us on Air Talk. Much more conversation about as technology advances and can actually capture the full body and movements of an actor, how might that affect the creative process going forward? Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Actors can now digitally preserve themselves in perpetuity. What does that mean about who has the right to the ways in which an actor's image or recreation is used in creative work going forward? Also, what are some of the challenges technically in recreating the essence of the performer beyond just the physicality of the actor? Darren Handler with us, director of Digital Humans Group at Digital Domain in Playa Vista, and Jennifer Rothman, who's just down the street from Playa Vista, or just up on the bluff, I should say, Loyola Law School, Jennifer Rothman, professor. So you were talking about how state law is applicable if you're talking about something done in California. Is there any federal copyright law that applies here?
Yeah, so there's several federal laws that apply. So if a studio passed off one of these performances as an authentic performance by the actor and they didn't actually agree to it or participate, we could have a false endorsement or trademark claim. And then, of course, the studios, if they are using images that they've filmed, they would own the copyright to the images, and then they should be able to use them. And federal law in that area, federal copyright law, tends to overcome state law in that regard. So there are a number of cases, actually, where actors and studios have come into conflict historically. For example, the well-known Cheers case, where George Wendt and John Ratzenberger sued over the licensing of the Norman Cliff characters for use as robots in airport bars. So we may see more of those conflicts involving digitized actors. But also there's the issue, and this is something that's central to my book, is that the right of publicity, the state law that we talked about, if it can turn people into intellectual property, which means that their rights can be transferred. So it's supposed to be helping actors control uses of their image, but a studio could have the actors transfer over their rights to the studio itself, and then they would own the actor potentially forever, even after death.
So that could be in the initial contract with the actor when she or he is hired for a particular role?
Correct. And that's something that's very concerning to me and is something the Screen Actors Guild is trying to promote the passage of these laws but isn't restricting their transferability. It's actually encouraging the transferability, which could be very dangerous for actors going forward. And in fact, some of these laws were initially proposed by the movie studios in the aftermath of the collapse of the star system when California law invalidated long-term studio contracts that held actors hostage to particular studios.
We're talking with Jennifer Rothman, law professor, Loyola Law School, author of the book The Right to Publicity, Reimagined for a Public World, came out just a few months ago, and Darren Handler with us of Digital Domain, where he directs the Digital Humans Group. Darren, wanted to ask you about the ways that you attempt to transfer the subtleties of that sense of an actor to the digitized image. What are the ways you try and address that challenge?
Well, absolutely. It's kind of an interesting process we go through, and sort of newer and newer technology is really helping us, you know, sort of aid this process. But we generally work with the actors and we do a whole series of different scans of them, you know, scans to figure out kind of how their skin moves. You know, we may even do scans to figure out how the color of their skin is changing as blood flow is moving around in their face. And we sort of generate all this data that gives us a good idea of how the actor's face moves, how they're performing. And then what we do is from their live action performances, when they're on set with the other actors, we're able to shoot their faces from different angles, different cameras and things, and then recreate their facial performances, right? Really down to the subtlety of their, you know, subtle emotions, twitches on their face and everything. And this is something that's kind of been fairly new, right? This technology has evolved so far and I think has really enabled us to sort of better recreate the actors' performances, right? So we're no longer, you know, using their performances as a guide or following along with their performances. We're now really sort of using their performances, their facial performances, their body performances, and then transferring it to these different characters and different actors and different creatures and all sorts of things.
Can you give us an example of where you did this in a recent film with an actor and with one of these digitized characters?
Absolutely. So we did this recently for Avengers Infinity War, where we took Josh Brolin's performances. And Josh Brolin was on set live with all the other actors. He was creating his performances. He was creating the body performances of Thanos. And so we're taking his body performances and his facial performances from set while he's talking and interacting with the other actors. And we're tracking, you know, thousands of points on his face and how his face is moving. And then we're looking at his face and we're looking at Thanos' face and we're looking at the different anatomies between the different characters and then transferring all of that subtlety, but figuring out at the same time what Josh's performance would and should look like on Thanos' face and really trying to make it his performance, almost like it's a digital prosthetic.
And as you're describing, Professor Rothman, is it clear then if the studio wanted to reuse Brolin and they thought it was appropriate for another digitized character that they could reuse that without Brolin's permission?
Well, a lot of that would depend on the contract that Brolin signed as well as collective bargaining with the Screen Actors Guild in that context. The studio would own the copyright in the footage, and so the copyright law says you can reuse it in a variety of ways as the owner. One of the main limits is probably whether the reuse would interfere or destroy Brolin's career. So if it was a complete replacement for Brolin's performances in other films, then I think courts would be more inclined to strike it down. And the one case, right of publicity case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court, involved such a scenario where a human cannonball performer had been filmed at a local fair, and the nightly news showed his entire act, albeit 15 seconds in length. And the Supreme Court said, First Amendment isn't going to protect the news here because you used the entire performance, and that could ruin the cannonball performer's career.
Well, in this case, though, with Brolin, let's say that the studio decided they just wanted to keep reusing because they could make that capture of his face almost infinite, let's say, so they don't need to hire him for future, right. Well, you know. Darren.
The one thing to mention, just the way some of this technology works is, so for instance, there were going to be other actors playing Thanos. And we would use the same type of technology to have them drive the face, but it's never going to be Josh's performance, the way Josh had crafted that performance. It's only really when he's playing that character and we're using his face that you're getting that performance, the way he did it onto Thanos. And everyone else may be mimicking it or trying to follow it along, but it's never really going to be that same performance ever again.
Darren, what really don't have. Oh, go ahead. Finish your point. I'm sorry.
And we really don't have the technology that would ever take Josh's performances and the way he did it and be able to recreate different alternate performances the way he did it at this moment.
I understand the technology isn't there right now, but isn't that at some point, you know, in the realm of possibility?
It could be in the realm of possibility. You know, we do lots of conversations about artificial intelligence and what this technology is going to be capable of. I would say the difficulty right now is, you know, we can't really get an artificial intelligence entity to come off as a human being, never mind create this perfect Josh Brolin performance again the way he did it. And so while the technology may be possible in the future, that's still a really, really long way off.
I want to thank you so much. That's Darren Handler of Playa Vista-based Digital Domain. He directs the Digital Humans Group there and has been involved with the digital effects capture of actors' performances in a number of films, including Avengers Infinity War, we were just talking about. And my thanks to specialist in right of publicity and intellectual property law, Professor Jennifer Rothman, Loyola Law School. Thank you so much for being with us. She's author of the book, The Right of Publicity, Reimagined for a Public World. And thanks, of course, to our Film Week critics as well, Christy Lemire and Wade Major joining us. I hope you'll join me for our next Film Week screening series, Theater at Ace Hotel, Sunday afternoon, December 2nd at 1 o'clock. We're going to show The Artist, that fairly new silent film. We're going to have a post-film conversation as well. Tickets, kpcc.org/in-person.